Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. And for those of you just joining us, thank you so much for joining. And we got a special treat today. This has been one of the interviews that I've been trying to get for a while. And really excited to talk to Professor Dave Cullum. Professor, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the show.
Yeah, thrilled to be here.
All right.
I should be an easy catch, actually. Enough of a hot dog.
Yeah. Well, thrilled to be here. We'll see if you say that after the show. So, everybody, first of all, I want to introduce you correctly, because the way that we ran into each other, the way that I found you was on social media, and I saw this guy posting all these things that I really thought were right on the money and really prescient. And then I read your Twitter biography, and I'm seeing that you are a professor of organic chemistry, and yet you're on FinTwit talking economics. Later, I find out that you're also one of the preeminent experts on a bird. What is the bird that you and your wife are involved in? I'm forgetting what kind of bird it is.
Osprey.
Oh, the osprey, yeah. Okay, so I just want to start from a point. Like I said, I've got a big list of questions. I've never had so many questions. I want to start from a point of sitting there going, okay, I want to hear your life story. I want to hear how you got here, how a libertarian/conservative professor survives in the Ivy Leagues, what, and then how you got so tied into economics and finance. That's a big question I'm throwing out there, but kind of give us the story of Dave Cullum and how you are so tied into all these different worlds, if you could.
Well, I can give you about a 2 or 3 minute version, I guess. So I started out, I grew up in Syracuse. My dad ran a construction company with about 350 people in it. So he understood economics better than most of the PhDs. He knows how the system works. We have had lots of discussions, the message being if you talk to your kids, they will remember, I think. We talked about inflation, and we talked about merit-based raises, and we talked about, you know, why excess capital is a problem and distressed investing and things like that. I went off to Cornell. I was really unfocused in high school, at least unfocused on academic things, and I went off to Cornell. As an undergrad, study bio. Thought I was going to go to first vet school, then med school, and then at the last minute decided to go into chemistry as a lark. And so I was a genetics major, slipping over to chemistry. That's in itself a contrarian move. I went to Columbia. And again, I was an okay student at Cornell. I worked incredibly hard, but since I did nothing in high school, I didn't really know how to be a student. But I got to Columbia, and things went well. And I managed to get my degree in about 2.5 years at Columbia. And then I went back to, I interviewed for jobs and went back to Cornell as an assistant professor. So got there, decided to switch fields again, within organic chemistry at least, but as an assistant professor sort of flipped over to a more sort of mathematically oriented thing, which was interesting because I had no math at all. Was a chemist, total focus with sort of unbridled sort of attention to it until around 92 maybe. And I you know, just in the context of retirement and investing and stuff, I started paying attention again. I was a wild raging bull through most of the 90s, and I just thought this really was a transformational period. And I made it a lot of money by just, you know, buying. You know, I bought a small company called LDDS, which turned into WorldCom. You know, that was a big win.
I sold it before
it tanked. Dell Computer, things like that. Around July of 98, I started getting real nervous. I don't know how I got onto it, but I'm going, you know, the math doesn't add up where things are too expensive. And so I actually dumped half my equities around July 1st, I remember. And we almost immediately went into the Asian crisis. And I'm thinking, you're either a half of a genius or a half of an idiot. I said I was going to get the rest out of it, came back. And by mid-99, I was out, completely 100% out. I've never been an incrementalist. And so the other weird thing is I jumped into gold, and I can't tell you who talked me into it, but I went pure cash plus a lot of gold in 99 and waited 2 years for the gold to bottom out. And then you know, felt like an idiot. And then that paid off well. So it was like a tenfold gain there while everyone else was getting crushed. And I even had some short position, which I rarely ever do. I like to think about this stuff, but I don't actually like doing it. So again, I became a bear, and it's really hard not to be a bear once you're a bear. And so there's times where being reckless and crazy pays handsomely. So I did great from January 1st of 2000 through around 2009. While the rest of the world was getting crushed, I think that 10-year period I compounded 13%. And then I was doing fine, and then gold got pounded. The only equities I had were things like I was buying energy the whole way, and that seemed really smart, and then I got crushed by that. So the last 10 years I've been bearish, and it has by outcome been shown to be wrong, but I'm still convinced that in principle I'm correct. And so to your listeners, what I'll point out is that in the last 10 years, the markets have run 300%, very much without me on board. And while the GDP grew 30%, and markets, to the extent they reflect economic growth, and GDP, to the extent it reflects economic growth, correlate. Well, apparently not in the last 10 years. And so I think my current premise is, A, it would have been nice to be oblivious and buy into this story. I think the last 10 years, the GDP has just been awful. I think the economy's been pretty awful for a recovery. And I think that we're going to get our asses royally kicked at some point in the future, possibly worse than 2008-2009. I actually think it should be worse than 2008-2009.
Yeah.
And during that whole period, I got into whole monetary theory and all that stuff. So it's hard to be a bear without thinking a little harder. It's easy to be a bull.
Yeah, boy, you're telling me. And I've got a similar experience, just because we're running, you know, retail money and managing money. I've had to be more bullish over that last 10 years than I wanted to be. Yeah, right. I mean, it's the number one reason why you lose clients is underperformance, and that's been a struggle for us. Just because, like you said, you know, it just doesn't. We look at the world in kind of a bifurcated manner, right? We've got pre-2008 and post-2008, and the world hasn't made a lot of sense. And then one of the things we point out, to your point, is when you look at the economic growth from 2008 to 2018, it was actually on a real basis, not nominal, but on a real basis, we had worse growth than we had in the Great Depression.
I cited that number in one of my write-ups. We really tracked the Great Depression from like 31 to 39 was the same as from 09 to 17, something like that.
I might have gotten that data point from you. And the funny thing is, though, is asset prices behaved a little bit differently in this run that we've had over the last 9 years than they did in the Great Depression, for sure. And I mean, you know, there's obviously a lot of reasons for that. We didn't have a Fed that was, well, they're data dependent, Dave. You know, they're
yeah, that means they're clueless idiots, right, in my opinion. But okay,
yeah, okay. So okay, then the other thing, and I want to get in. Okay, and we gotta just remind everybody here who we're talking to. We got David Collum with us, Professor David Collum, professor at Cornell, and organic chemistry, and I guess it wouldn't be fair to call you moonlighting in the finance world, because it's kind of like you're tied into every. Here's the other one. I'm jumping around here because I want to make sure I get all the questions in. How did you get so tied in to Wall Street? Just watching your Twitter feed, the guys you know, the people you've got connections. How did all that come about? How did you get tied into, you know, the Einhorns and all these different guys? Where did that come from?
That's kind of an interesting question. No one's ever asked me that question before, but I've thought about it. There's a couple of answers to that question. One is when the internet was younger at least. I would read an article by someone and I'd be impressed, or I'd have a question or something, and I would just pop out an email to the person. And, you know, I can remember early people I contacted like that. For example, I used to swap emails with Elizabeth Warren late at night. and I think she's a different person now, but at the time she was just this compassionate, very left-leaning, and she cared about the little person. How do you argue with that? And we'd swap emails back and forth. And I wrote a couple blogs for her, but I go, why am I doing this? Who the hell knows who this lady is, right? And guys like Jim Rickards and Chris Whalen, and these guys were easy to reach because you know, sort of this open communication was just starting. So people would get an email, like, oh, wow. I got to know one of Louis Bacon's proteges, a hedge fund manager who happened to have a tie with Cornell, one of the bear market chat boards years ago, who I got to know well, and real genius type. And he said, you can get to people I can't get to. And I said, why do you think that is? And he says, because you're a professor. And, yeah. And that really resonated, because everybody we know, every single person has remembers being in college, and the professors are these authority figures. And I realized that I probably have a 98% response rate on emails. You know, they don't get buried. They somehow the people respond, and I think it's because they all had professors who were sort of seriously elevated in their mind. And I think you never quite lose that. So I always got taken seriously, and then the network started, and then and I started writing these annual reviews of the year, and they started to go viral, and then I think from there, yeah, I've run into people in Singapore and stuff who know about it. I go, that's ridiculous, right? And so I think, and at this point, I become the Paris Hilton of finance, right? I'm famous for being famous, I guess. I don't know. I do have the ability to sort through baloney, I think. I'm kind of a MacGyver type, I think, intellectually. I don't do it with sophisticated thought process. I kind of, you know, put the knife between my teeth and, you know, put some eye shade and bandana on and try to figure out what's going on. And that's how I do chemistry, too, it turns out. I don't I got my way through a lot of stuff that other people miss. And it really comes down to this sort of this horse sense.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what my forte is common sense, logic, deductive reasoning, no math.
Well, and that's kind of what gravitated me to your feed and your thoughts and your musings and writings, was because that kind of echoes me, right? I was more trained in the financial field. I've spent my entire career there. But I've always, I probably, due to the way you're raised, put a real premium on common sense. And I think there's a lot of these talking heads out there that can build a financial model, and they can, you know, use all the, you know, the correct vernacular and you know, sound really smart. But at the end of the day, what I see so much in the financial world, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this as well, but really a smart analyst in look, I'm not trying to take down any of these. There's some brilliant analysts out there and all that, you know, brilliant people, great insight. But especially like on the CNBC or the televised news and things of that nature, it's so much just an echo chamber, right? They all get up there. I'm reminded of the talk at the end of 2015 where, you know, that whole bear market in gold, I mean, we're still there. We haven't broken out. But from 2011 to 2015, the rationale behind all that was, of course, gold cannot rise at the same time that interest rates are going up. Right. And that I don't know if you were familiar with or paid attention to that dogma, but it was just constantly repeated. Right.
Yeah. And the facts say precisely the opposite.
Right.
Right. And, you know, so if you, I read a lot of history and neuropsychology and stuff like that, too. And you really quickly figure out that there's some serious that all the different biases that humans suffer from, they're all on display. You could check, play bias bingo watching CNBC and you'd be yelling bingo all the time.
Oh, yeah. So. No. And that's kind of where, and I would love, and I'm leading to a question here. So stick with me, the listeners, stay with us here. But one of the things that I was struck by is I listened to that narrative just go on, right? And started with gold at 11,000 or excuse me, at 1900 bucks. And it, that narrative just kept rolling and rolling and rolling. And finally, I kind of came to a conclusion that, look, it may not be the beginning of the big bull run, but I think this is a classic, you know, sell the news type scenario. And we started sitting there going, hey, when they announce their first rate hike, if gold trades positive, why we picked 2 days, I'm not really sure why, but we thought, okay, if gold trades positive for 2 days following the rate hike, I think you're going to have a lot of people off sides. I think it's a great time to be in gold. Now, there was no fundamental reasoning behind it, but we both know what happened over 2015 to early 2016 in gold markets, and that's probably been our best trade of the last 3 years, certainly. And yet, And it kind of struck me because I sat there and I went, you know, this is a philosophical market, meaning that I feel like the central banks and all this printed money have suspended reality. And you've got to think outside the technical side of it. And it's become more ethereal and it's become more, you know, for lack of a better term, I guess, philosophical. It just feels like they've suspended gravity and everything's just floating around. Have you noticed that? Do you think I'm off in that assessment? And especially as it relates to the situation I was outlining there at the end of 2015, do you think we've, you know, had some type of gravity suspension and things have become just more free floating?
Well, there's a whole the layers to that onion you just laid out. first and foremost, every great mania has a story. You know, the whether it's some South Sea bubble or whether it's a tulip mania or whether it's the 1920s tech boom. Oh my God, we just invented electrical appliances and planes and cars. Of course, we're just going to get rich forever. And then we had the Great Depression as this great, you know, sort of projectile vomit to the excessive credit creation of the 20s. And people, you know, Bernanke's either an idiot or a liar. I don't know which, but he's one of the two, and I don't think he's an idiot. And that's because he always points to the problem with the Depression being mistakes made in the Depression. The huge mistakes were made in the 1920s. It's right. Very straightforward. They created all sorts of credit bubbles throughout the 20s, and there was all sorts of consumer credit bubbles. And then credit bubbles blow up. They just simply blow up. They get to the point where they just can't sustain themselves. And then we had we had kind of the nifty 50 bubble in the 60s, and we had inflationary pressures that were huge, and they got ignored until they couldn't be ignored anymore. And then the tech bubble was a classic, right? You had teenagers making a ton of money, and the valuations got so profoundly ridiculous. And that's the real bubble that I personally lived through and spotted in advance. I have the best thing I ever wrote. This is the thing I'm most proud of, was an email to a friend at Goldman in May 6th of 2002, in which he asked me in an email, why are you so jumpy? And I spent about a 5-page email laying out the subprime crisis. And I talked about how GE Capital was taking on all sorts of interest rate risk, and how the banks were taking on subprime mortgages, and this was 5 years before it blew, right?
I was going to say, Dave, hold on. Was this the piece you wrote in 2002 that I just read the other day?
I don't remember, but it was an email that I posted.
Okay.
And I occasionally post it just to, you know, flip the bird at someone who says, you know, if someone says no one saw it coming, or they say this is the person who saw it coming. I personally know probably 400 people who saw the problem coming. So that's just stupid thinking, right? I know very few who played it brilliantly, leveraged, you know, phenomenal profits. I was just heading into fetal position, but I knew it was coming. I stood in front of my class in March of 07, and I was lecturing on organic chemistry, and I just stopped. I always tell stories, ridiculous stories. And I said, the banking system's about to collapse. And they looked at me, and I said, yeah, you could actually find yourself going to your ATM machine not being able to get money, right?
Yeah.
So that's pretty clearly seeing it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then 2 years later, I had the same kids in honors thesis research. And the first day of class, I said, I told you the banking system's going to collapse. Like February of 09, right? This was when all hell was breaking loose. And I said, I told you about it, right, in class? They go, yes, you did. And I did it. I said, did any of your econ professors tell you? And they go, no. And I said, what are those jerks paid for?
Yeah.
Right? What are they doing to earn their salaries, right? So my first guest lecture in honors chemistry thesis research was the CEO of Morgan Stanley Bank. and he gave a two-hour lecture on the catastrophe going on in the mortgage markets. And I think we got another one coming.
Yep.
Right? So here's the finish of that pitch, and that is the most recent mania, and this is a mania, and I can't believe they pulled it off again. And the storyline behind this one is not transformational society. It's that central banks have our backs. What kind of stupid, moronic person buys that story? And apparently it's everybody on the planet.
Yeah.
And so they've all bought into it. I'm sitting there and I chat with people and I go, how did they get this bonfire roaring again? I don't get it. So in any event, I think it's going to collapse. You can do the math. I looked at probably 20 different metrics of valuation. What's a metric of valuation? It's the price of markets divided by something important. GDP, you know, book value, profits, you name it. There's tons of them. And they all say we're 2x overvalued. Now, tell me what's going to happen if all the pensions and all the endowments and all the people's bank accounts cut in half. Now, tell me what's going to happen this time. Unlike 2007 to 2009, when the bond market saved everybody, well, this time the bond market can't save everybody because the bond market's in a bigger bubble than the stock market.
Yeah.
And so tell me what's going to happen when the bond market and the stock market go to hell in a handbasket simultaneously.
Okay. Well, hold on. I want to continue this. We got to take a quick break, take commercial break. Let's hold this thought because I want to come back and push on this a little bit more. There's still a lot of good stuff here that we haven't talked about. So anyway, hang with us, Dave. We'll be right back. Thank you guys for listening. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
This is Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham. Listen to Zach uncover the truth about the financial markets with simple and honest advice to help you plan for retirement. Get your free copy of Zach's new booklet, Common Sense Investing. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.
I have to tell you, what a relief for my wife and me when we got signed up for long-term care coverage. The more I learned about the fact that nearly 3 out of 4 of us will need some form of long-term care in our retirement, there are so many issues at play. For some people, they can't afford it and they become a burden on their friends and family. For others, you do have money set aside, but it wipes out everything that you've saved. And maybe most importantly, it's about having a plan so that all your children have to do is carry out your wishes. It's not a burden on them. And that's why I love the advice we got from Brian Ott and 525 Advisors. We started by going to one of Brian's free classes, and that's what I recommend you do to find out about all the different plans they offer. Brian does have a few classes coming up this month. Seats are limited, so sign up now at 525longtermcare.com. You'll get a free copy of Brian's book, too. Go to 525longtermcare.com, 525longtermcare.com.
Volatile markets are never fun.
but it provides the opportunity to see exactly how much risk you're exposed to. Like Warren Buffett always says, when the tide goes out, you find out who's been swimming without their trunks on. Hey, it's Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. Chances are the defense portion of your portfolio, the bonds, got hit right along with your stocks. So what do you do? Look, safety doesn't have to mean lower returns. By using our bond replacement strategy, our clients have actually increased their returns while being insured against loss and all the while lowering their fees. Call now and get your free copy of our brand new booklet, Common Sense Investing, and learn how to protect your retirement against loss but still participate in market gains. Call 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Or go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Bulwark Capital Management's a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us, and we're going to jump right back into it. We're lucky enough to be joined by Professor Dave Collum, a social media Twitter acquaintance of mine that we're getting a chance to talk to here, professor at Cornell, organic chemistry, and also somewhat of a finance savant or you know, a moonlighter in the financial world, and one of the most interesting guys that I follow. And so, I wanted to bring this to the listeners, and we were just discussing, in my opinion, Dave laid out perfectly the disaster in 08-09. We were just going over that, and there was something that you said that altered the course of my career, because a lot of people did see it coming. I count myself as one of them, and I fit perfectly into that bracket that you outlined of, you know, seeing it coming, performing okay during that period of time, but not knowing. I'd never heard of a credit default swap. For that matter, I'd never heard of quantitative easing. I was trying to find a way to short housing directly. I didn't know enough. I didn't know that that issue had metastasized out into the banks the way it had. And I was at Russell Investments at the time. Are you familiar with Russell, Dave?
No.
Okay, Russell 2000. They invented the Russell 2000 index.
Oh, I know those guys.
Yeah.
Didn't know it was the same ones. Yeah, sure.
They were headquartered here. They're now headquartered in Seattle. They were headquartered in my hometown of Tacoma. And so I started there right out of college. And from the end of 2006 to 2007, you know, I'd been watching I was raised in a broker dealer. My father and grandfather started a brokerage firm in the early 80s. So I was raised in that environment. And, you know, being up close to those things kind of gives you a different perspective. You know, I still remember Black Monday, 87. The look on my father's face walking through the door is kind of frozen, into my memory. And yeah, I guess I'm just more of not a pessimist. I'm an optimistic guy, but just more of a skeptic. And you're watching this real estate thing heat up, and you're watching everybody and their mother making tons of money, and you're watching them refi the house and buying a boat, and you could just see the money pouring from the retail sector into the overall economy. And I remember walking around Russell at the time. I still remember when I finally pulled the plug and went to 100% treasuries was in either late October, early November 2007. And there was a gentleman there that was running a $2.5 billion hedge fund inside of Russell, because they had some alternative offerings, and they ran a couple different hedge funds. And he overheard me talking to my wife. She also worked there at the time, and overheard me saying, let's sell everything. I was managing a small amount of money at my father's broker dealer, kind of on the side at that point, and then managing our own money. And just said, let's pull out. This is nuts. I couldn't get my head around the idea that, you know, the line going around at the time was you got to buy real estate because God's not making any more of it. You know, there was there were all these anecdotal things, right, that everybody was using to justify this run up. And it was as simple as me looking at it and saying, listen, if 8% a year is the new normal, in 5 years, no one's gonna be able to afford a house. And then a buddy of mine that was making about $45,000 a year at the time got a mortgage for like $450,000, and in a matter of days, right? It was just easy. those, you know, the liar loans, all that kind of stuff. And I just went, this is nuts. This is nuts. And I got a 10-minute lecture from the head of this hedge fund about not being able to time the market and how, you know, everything's fine and this is just a bump in a road and it's all priced in. And I got that from a lot of people at Russell. And sure enough, we all know what happened. And I sat there and watched it. And I think we were, you know, I think on our treasuries, we made like 13 or 14% from that time until the bottom in March of 09. So, you know, it's, I'm not a Kyle Bass. I didn't, you know, see any of that stuff coming. I didn't know well enough to short the banks. But these things were easy to spot. And you know, to a large extent, like I agree with you, if you don't have your head in the sand, I think the same could be said of the internet bubble. And now we fast forward to today, because I think that this, and I've said it on Twitter before, I think that this environment is substantially tougher because it's not one thing, right? It's everything.
It's everything.
And we've had this, we've had low growth, you know, equal, similar, we just outlined this in the previous segment, but similar output, economic output to the Great Depression, yet record asset prices across the board. And
can I interject something?
Absolutely.
Here, just so the listeners don't miss this.
Yes.
The default sort of rationalization is going to be that things were so cheap in 09, and that is factually incorrect. And so if you say, well, you know, if March of 09 was the equivalent of, you know, 1933, when the Dow bottomed out at 41, then that would be fine. In March of 09, when the markets hit their ultimate bottom for that cycle, the markets had pretty much just hit fair value by historical metrics.
Right.
They had not corrected the profoundly deep value pricing. And so the bounce off that should have been pathetic.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but we just didn't factor in QE. Right. We didn't factor in the Fed going full drunken sailor and just pumping money into the system.
Yeah. All feds.
Yeah. Right.
Central banks around the world.
Right. Right. And you said something earlier, too, about not believing that they've been able to hold it together this long. I continue to sit there and look at the calendar and see 2019 and absolutely dumbfounded that we're sitting there with markets where they're at, with valuations where they're at. And of course, if you turn on Bubble Vision, we had Bill Fleckenstein on the show, you know, his thoughts about, about CNBC. We did about a 20-minute smackdown of CNBC, and, it was pretty cathartic actually. But, looking at the valuations, everybody's going to talk. We have a saying at our firm, which is trailing 12-month PEs are what you use when you want to buy a stock. Forward PEs are what you use when you're trying to sell a stock.
That's exactly right. And by the way, it has to be trailing gap PEs and probably a Case-Shiller, Case, you know, whatever PE, the CAPE ratio. You know, there's a lot of ways that are better than the standard PE that you pick up on TV.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you go to the old Warren Buffett valuation metric and you sit
right
there and see that we are at a peak now, especially with this rebound we've had over the last couple months. We're at a peak now that we've only seen anything comparable in 99 and 1929. So my question to you is
actually 29 wasn't comparable.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. We're way above that level. That's sanity compared to where we're at today.
Right.
And then I'm sitting there watching today, and I don't know if you saw it, but I tweeted this thing out, and I don't like to, you know, I don't need to pick on Jim Cramer at all, you know, our thoughts on Jim Cramer, whatever. But he put out this tweet, and he was referring to Microsoft as cheap. Well, I looked at it really quick, and again, I got in trouble a couple weeks ago for calling out Boeing on the show, and so I'm going to attack another stalwart here in the Seattle area. So please, no calls about this. I don't want to get any more angry shareholder calls. But I took a quick glance at Microsoft. I knew it was expensive. I didn't realize it was trading at almost a 30 PE and 8x sales. This is an $850 billion market cap. 8x sales.
And wow, that's big.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sitting there looking at Jim Cramer calling this cheap. And I'm sitting there, and like I said, the length of this run has just befuddled me. And the question I've got, when you're managing money, you got to think about all sides. I know you know this, and you're trying to think about, what did I miss? Is there some way you think that that these guys have rigged this thing and they've changed the way that equities are going to be priced? Is there any type of rational spin that we can put on this, that it can last long? I mean, how much longer do you think we've got here in this cycle?
Well, my nightmare scenario is a long time. But here's the problem. The more you pay for an asset, the less you will get in return.
Right.
If Toyota Camry is a great car, and it has great trade-in value. If you pay $80,000 for one, you're not going to win. And so I came up with this little maxim that some will recognize as a maxim based on savings, where people say savings is consumption deferred, and debt is consumption pulled forward. Right.
Yeah.
So that boat you buy today, you're not going to buy tomorrow. And what I pieced together was a pricing one, and that is that overvaluation is appreciation pulled forward, and undervaluation is appreciation deferred. I want my appreciation in the future, not the past. You read guys like Jesse Felder or what's his face? I'm drawing a dead blank. But a number of these guys who use raw valuation, Hussman and yep. Jeremy Grantham, and these guys have this very rational approach. They say, look, the markets are currently priced at this level, and if in 10 years, over a path we do not care about, the economy grows in a fairly normal way, and then at the same time, in 10 years, we've regressed to a historical mean, what will your return be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you watch, you can do 20. Grantham has switched to 20. I think it's just to give positive numbers. Now, the value you get for most projected 10-year returns by those who are thinking this way is usually about a negative 3% return per year for 10 years, with a GDP growing normal to get to fair value. Grantham set takes it out to 20 years and says you'll get, 2% or 3% over 20. But no one can live off that very well. And by the way, Grantham and these guys rarely include things like taxes, and they rarely include – and taxes, by the way, are not just on real returns. They're on inflated returns, right? If you double your money on inflation, you pay taxes on that. You didn't just tie inflation. You lost. And so you're paying taxes, you're paying fees. They're all over the place. We can't see them, but they're there. And as a consequence, the sustainable long-term return over the last 150 years, when you throw in everything, I came up with around 4%, 4 to 5 over, which is essentially an infinite period of time. And I've seen guys like Rob Arnault comes in at 3.5%. But I don't think he's including fees, though. Maybe he is. So the normal return is small compared to what you think. It's a big lie that markets give 8%. It's just a monstrous lie. And that does not include our starting point.
Right.
And the other thing it does not include, and this is pretty weird and nobody has ever presented this to the best of my knowledge, and that is it doesn't include a quadrupling of the population. And if you include the quadrupling, you say, well, why does that matter? Well, if the pie is quadrupled, but the number of people eating from the pie is quadrupled, you've gained nothing.
Right. Right.
Right. That's 0.4% a year.
Yeah, you're right.
That's a big number.
I haven't thought about it in that way. You're right.
No one has.
Yeah.
And so I throw all that in. I get bleak returns without correcting for the valuation. Once you say, okay, let's regress to the mean, we're just in trouble. And guess what? I think it's timed perfectly to cause max pain, right? We all know that rule, that the markets will find a way to get everybody into the pool before it throws in the toaster oven and fries them all. The maximum amount of pain, GE toaster oven to be precise,
yep.
The maximum amount of pain is going to be that the markets are going to be destructively either bad or mediocre for an awesome period of time right as the boomers need it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that goes right into my next question for you, which is, and for those of you just joining us, we're lucky enough to be joined by Professor David Collum, organic chemistry professor at Cornell, and also a market expert. I'm going to call you that. I know you wouldn't refer to yourself as that, but I love the way you look at these things and the common sense approach you take. And one of the things that we talk about on the show quite frequently, we actually did an ad, one of our ads that run for the show on radio, and referenced Warren Buffett's old saying, right? You find out who's swimming without their trunks on when the tide goes out. And I love that one because it's also an aspect that I think that people forget. And we've seen it over and over and over and over that the longer these economic runs take place, the more nonsense and garbage gets built up, right, in the places that we can't see it. And I personally think that Boeing is a classic example of this, right? Everybody's on board with the cost-cutting measures they've taken, and they've recreated their business and all. And you step back and you take a look at it and you go, wait a second. For me to believe that, I also have to believe that great managers like Alan Mulally, who formerly ran the company, were morons compared to the guys that are currently in charge, right? And I just have a really hard time believing that. And then, you know, you see, and again, I'm not saying that there's a correlation, but we've done several interviews with Boeing executives, and we've heard that management is myopically focused on this $800 stock price. We've heard it from several different levels, senior executives in the accounting department. We've really dug into this, and I feel like there are valuations much more obscene out there than Boeing. I think Microsoft is much more obscene, and there's a lot worse offenders out there.
The Fangs.
Fang Juniors is what we call them. The Palo Alto Networks, and not bad companies, just prices that don't make any sense. And my thought is, okay, we're looking at this valuation issue. We're looking at this complete separation from underlying fundamentals. What are we going to find when the tide finally goes out? Because I think it's going to be a lot worse than a lot of us are sitting here thinking. We're just seeing the tip of the iceberg from my perspective. What do you think we're going to discover when the tide finally goes out on this Fed-driven liquidity ocean that they've created?
Well, let me first, I'm going to present a counter argument to Boeing, which is more bearish than yours. That is, I noticed Boeing starting to go, and then, because it really did go hyperbolic pretty fast.
Yep.
And then I started looking around, and you start looking at companies like McDonnell Douglas and Raytheon and stuff like that, and they all did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then the question is, and this is the horrifying question, is are they responding to profits in the present because we're bombing the hell out of everybody and it costs a lot of money and they're getting all these government contracts, not just from our government, from all the Middle Eastern countries and you name it? Or, this is the horrifying part, is the market, the all-knowing market, which is a ridiculous concept, but let's just play along here for a minute, that somehow the market is sensing that these defense companies are going to make a fortune in the future. Right?
Yeah.
And that's World War III coming, right? That's what they're pricing in. So now, with that said, amongst the crowd that I hang with, in which we all do confirmation bias together.
But you recognize it.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. You can't take a contrarian position without finding people to say, Dave, you're going to be okay.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah.
you no one can be contrary to the point where everybody thinks you're an idiot, right? You got to find some support group or something where you stand up and you say, hi, my name's Dave, I'm a bear, and everyone says, hi, Dave, you know, that sort of thing.
And Bears Anonymous.
Like Fleckenstein were important to me.
Yeah.
Fleckenstein, Rickards, all these guys, they played very important roles. But in any event, amongst the confirming bias squad that I hang with, the corporate debt is monstrous.
Oh.
It's just absolutely monstrous. And so when corporate debt starts to fail, and then the question becomes, how do you bail out corporate debt? It's one thing to bail out, you know, Fannie Mae, which is kind of a government agency, and Freddie Mac, and dump money into banks. But when companies start going belly up and floating into the harbor, you know, bankrupt. What the heck's going to happen? And you got companies like GE that's already bankrupt. Deutsche Bank's already bankrupt. These companies are on, you know, Kiernan and Quinlan companies. These are serious problems. And so, but when credit gets tight, and it always does, I don't need to explain to you why, because it doesn't matter. This is like teenage sex. It's going to happen. When that happens, what's going to happen to these companies that are up to their eyeballs in debt? And the answer is, I think we're going to have a bad time.
Now, so the one, let me throw, and I agree completely, but let me throw a fly in the ointment just for the sake of argument here. One of the things that, and I've had Brent Johnson on Santiago Capital. I know you're familiar with his stuff.
Appalling how many of your guests I'm familiar with. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. It's kind of
obsessive behavior.
Yeah. So he and I had him on for the same reason. It was kind of confirmation bias on my part too. I heard his dollar milkshake theory, and I just sat there and I went, this is the first guy. I thought I was nuts. Here this guy's painting a more articulate picture of exactly what I think's going to happen. And the only point he and I really differ on is the stocks. I have a really tough time seeing equities rally if the dollar's going to get that strong. But one of the things that we looked at and we spoke to Brent about, and we spend a lot of time thinking about, is Fed involvement. And the outlook that we have is that, you know, the whole argument that they're not going to ramp up quantitative easing again, or they're not going to do, and people often say, well, we can't afford it. We've shot our wad, right? We're done. And I look at them and I go, what's the difference between a $4 trillion balance sheet and a $10 trillion balance sheet? What do you think is going to keep the Fed from jumping in and going full Kuroda and BOJ and start buying up corporates, or the ECB, right? Buying up the
Draghi
corporates. Yeah, you know, whatever it takes. And I don't know if you're familiar with it, and I'm forgetting the name of it. I always do this. But there was this issue in the it was a European company, and it was in financial distress. Everybody knew it. And then you went out and priced their debt, and their debt was yielding 1.8%. And while their debt was yielding 1.8%, they announced bankruptcy.
Well, that's right. Well, so the European corporate junk bond index currently is pricing European corporate junk bonds. I don't know if it's still true. It's probably not true now, but it was true, below the rate of return of 10-year U.S. Treasuries.
Right.
So that's just nonsense. Anyone who thinks markets are efficient, that's just stupidity, right? That just shows you the profound distortions they put into the system. That one year I invented this concept of a monetary capacitor, and it got no legs. I can guarantee you this is this did not go viral. I've seen things go viral that I've done, but that's not one of them. But it's this idea that they're charging the capacitor and charging it and charging it, and they're going, nothing's happening, nothing's happening. And then that thing's going to crack and release. And if you watch the Weimar, if you look at the money velocity in the Weimar Republic in the 20s, and it turns out the velocity twice tanked. You go, well, low velocity means low inflation, right? The money's not chasing goods and services. Twice it tanked before it destroyed Germany and caused World War II.
Right.
And so the people looking at money velocity and looking at contemporary, concurrent evidence of inflation, which is already picking up, if they think somehow that means you're safe, that's like, you know, the guy in Pearl Harbor where a bomb goes shooting across the runway and Red sticks his head up and says, hey, guys, it's a dud, and then he gets his butt blown off.
No, that's a great analogy. But, okay, so to take it a step further, do you think the Fed's going to stop? I don't see it. I mean, I think that was confirmed there at the end of 2018. Powell comes out, and you know, I've heard Grant Williams talk about this, and I was of like mind where he was talking tough, and I thought, do we have a sane, transparent actor now at the head of the Fed and then we get a 20% correction. And look, I know it's not comfortable, but you and I both know 20% corrections, that's part of the game, right? What is the average?
That's just a hiccup.
Right, right. That's just part of the game.
Especially after 300%.
Right.
Just a hiccup.
Right. And he comes sprinting out of the Eccles building, and I put a pause on, right? We're going to softens. He goes, what they refer to as, he goes full dump. Right.
So it's worse than that. So we thought he was different. Right. And when Grant was interviewing, I one time drove 8 hour round trip to spend the afternoon with him and Simon Mikhailovic, just to chat. That's how much I like Grant.
Yeah.
And so the market's tanking by some standards, not by mine. People going, oh, Dave, is this the bottom? I go, this isn't even off the top yet. And then the first thing that happens is Mnuchin, that guy who's the butt ugly with the wife who to die for, right? Boy, I wonder if she married him for money. And he comes out and says that he's called out the plunge protection team, the president's working group on capital. We're going, what?
For 20%.
So that was the New Year's Eve massacre, where it caused this massive short squeeze as soon as the markets opened after Christmas, and they never looked back. But meanwhile, then Powell, who's starting to look really pathetic, I thought Yellen was bad, finds himself on stage with Yellen and Bernanke, and he's talking about supporting the asset markets. I'm going, my God, you're an idiot. That's just unbelievable. You know why he's an idiot? It's not just he's supporting asset markets. It's that he found himself caught on stage with those two other clowns speaking spontaneously. I read the minutes of the Fed, of the president of the Fed. It was McKinley, I think. After being president, he was president, I think, of the New York Fed. I think I got this right. And he says, I've written down my notes because I don't want to say anything that will cause a problem. Back in 1928, I think it was.
Wow.
So in any event, so Powell finds himself on stage, and then the nitwit goes on 60 Minutes. And it was like a fibathon. There were no lies, just tremendous amount of baloney.
Yep.
Like when he's asked about wealth inequality. You want to destroy the United States? Wealth inequality is going to do it. I am not a liberal. What I'm watching is I'm watching AOC and her socialists grab a hold of the microphone, and they're going to drive us into socialism, right? And it's because we screwed up the system in 08-09. And then we didn't hang a single banker. We should have lined them up and shot them one at a time in plain sight, put it on CNN. And instead, we had this no banker left behind policy, in which it was an explicit memo from Holder saying no prosecutions. And so the public's sitting there going, this stinks. We know this stinks. We saw no one get punished. We know they're criminals. And so now the rallying cry in 2020 is going to be the bankers got socialism. The bankers got a ton of money. Now it's our turn. And that is going to drive us into a bridge abutment. I'm watching this. I am terrified of the political climate now. And my terror has picked up markedly in about 3 weeks.
Yeah, no, I I concur. I remember at the time when we first heard what was going on in 08-09, I felt like an idiot because I sat there and I went, "What is quantitative easing?" I didn't know what it was, and I'm kind of a wonk, you know. I'm very wonkish. I'm one of those guys that reads the Fed minutes too, and you know, reads the BIS reports and all, you know, all these things. I was sitting there scratching my head, going, "What is this quantitative easing?" And when I got my hands around what they were doing, and again, I feel like this is where we have this giant separation between, financial philosophy, which is I refer to that as I think that's really what economics has become or turned into, or what it is. It's more of an economic philosophy or financial philosophy. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself, you know, if you wanted to create a wealth gap in an economy, I think
that's it.
Right. I think the two best things you could do is drop rates to zero while simultaneously tightening lending standards. right? So we're now the only people that can access the credit markets are people that have really healthy balance sheets or rich people, right? They're able to buy depressed assets at record low interest rates. And meanwhile, John Q. Public or you know, the guy next door, they can't take advantage of the 0% interest rates, right?
Well, except for the fact that they got a lot of car financing, and they tried to get them back in the mortgage market. They're going deeper into debt. So the quantitative easing, I believe most people still don't get it. And this helps. There's a name you'll be super familiar with. A lot of discussion with David Andelfato of the St. Louis Fed.
It's funny you bring him up, by the way.
And you can take that cue if you wish.
Yeah.
but he was the first person to sort of get me thinking differently about quantitative easing, where, you know, he and I would get in cat fights. But some of what he told me stuck. And what the Fed does, when the Fed buys treasuries, they create money from scratch. So everyone says, oh, they're printing money. But if you actually look at what it is they create the money from scratch. They buy the treasuries. So now the banks have cash instead of treasuries. But there's no additional assets out there. It's a different kind of asset. So they're doing what's called an asset swap. Now, the created money is just showing up as more treasuries on the Fed's balance sheet.
Right.
So they actually haven't printed money. So yet again, Bernanke lied because he said they did. Now, they did some money printing when they bought up crappy assets, and they ignored Badgett, and they didn't back banks with solid assets. They banked garbage. So all those houses that fell into the foundation, all those defaulting mortgages, they set up this thing called Maiden Lane 1 and Maiden Lane 2, and they bought up a bunch of this really garbage mortgage-backed security crap, and they threw it into these accounts, and I don't even know what happened to it. That's printing money,
yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
But the Fed's balance sheet going up to $4 trillion by buying treasuries. What it did is it gave banks cash instead of treasuries. And if the banks had needed cash before, without the quantitative, they would have had to have gone into the open market and paid cash to get treasuries, or sold treasuries to get cash. But if they sell treasuries to get cash, someone else now has treasuries instead of cash. So by buying treasuries, they've shifted the assets from treasury rich to cash rich.
Yeah.
And so the asset values don't change. The quality of the assets change. Now, here's where it gets interesting, I think. This is where someone who really knows what they're doing might say, Dave thinks he knows what he's doing. He doesn't. But but treasuries, amazingly enough, are not reserves. This is what I had to learn. They're not reserves. When a bank has treasuries, they can't use them as reserves. And to the extent there's statutory requirements on having a certain number of reserves for a rainy day, the treasuries don't count.
Really?
And someone email me if this is wrong. In any event, so now by swapping, they now put cash in the reserve accounts of the banks. Now they have reserves. And now the money multiplier can kick in, because they can say, okay, we can now lend out, you know, 12-fold or whatever the magic number is now, 12 times as much reserve as we have in reserves by statute. And so it increased the proportion of the reserves in their asset on their balance sheet. And that, in theory, allowed them to lend more. Now, what they ran into was a saturated credit market where the banks didn't want to lend more. And that's why we've had a pathetic recovery.
Yeah.
Because the banks are saying, yeah, fine, you gave me the reserves, but I don't want to lend to those nitwits. They're not creditworthy. So the banks are, in some sense, by not lending, are showing responsibility.
Right.
But
right.
Here's the crazy part. If they start, so the money multiplier, what do? They start creating what's bank-derived money. As soon as they start lending out, now there's cash in the system. You write a check to Joe Blow to buy a house. He buys a house. That money goes to someone else. That now is in the banking system, and that starts to become reserves too. So you get the snowball.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And that's what QE was. Now here's the deal is, so what they tried to do is basically get this autocatalytic, this self-perpetuating engine going. and it's kind of a Carnot engine. It's kind of a perpetual motion machine. And quantitative tightening is the reverse, where they take treasuries and sell them into the market. And that takes cash out of the system. Doesn't change the asset company. It takes cash. But now all of a sudden they can't lend. So I got into a fight on Twitter where I said, what's her face? Head of the SEC, Sheila Bair.
Yep.
Said the bank should have delevered over the last 10 years more. Right? That's a hint right there. She views the banks as too levered. And I said, how do you delever the banks without contracting the money supply? And I got a lot of flack, but no one convinced me that that question was invalid. If you want to delever the banks, they have to lend less. Now, all of a sudden, you don't have that money multiplier working out there, and the whole thing goes in reverse. So that's, I think, what QE and QT are about. Now, here's the other funny thing people don't know about. Back in, I think, 91, they passed a law that said the money the Fed makes goes back to the Treasury. So when we buy Treasury, let's say interest rates were 10%, that would cost the government a lot of money. But if the Fed buys those Treasuries and then collects the 10%, that goes back to the Treasury, so it's free money.
They're moving money from one pocket to the other.
Monetizing the debt of the government.
Yeah.
By doing QE.
Right.
Did any of that not make sense?
No, it made perfect sense, and that's the funny thing about it is, you know, everybody's like, well, we're not going to monetize debt, and I look at them and I'm like, what do you think that we've been doing?
They just did it. Yeah.
Right. They did it.
It was government debt.
Right. They did it to the tune of $4 trillion. All right. Dave, now we got to take another quick break, but I'm hoping you can stick with us for one more segment here. Do you have time?
Yep.
All right, perfect. All right, you guys, stick with us. We're going to be back with Professor Colum. Got a couple other great questions and topics we want to discuss, so don't go anywhere, but hang with us. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Do better in bull markets. Do better in bear markets. Pay less fees in all markets. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management. You can subscribe to Zach's free newsletter, The Bulwark Insider Report, at knowyourriskradio.com. AM 770 KTTH, Seattle. Brought to you by Leafless in Seattle Rain Gutter Guards.
Hey, it's Story Monson with my financial advisor, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. And Zach, what I love about you guys is your focus on risk management.
Well, Dory, we're a fiduciary and a holistic retirement planning firm. Our goals are simple. Get our clients the highest returns with the least amount of risk and cost.
I know they're normally used for safety, but how risky are bonds right now?
If a significant portion of your retirement portfolio is in cash or bonds, that just doesn't work in this low interest rate environment on the verge of inflation. You need a bond replacement strategy.
I gotta tell you, you have to read it. Zach's brand new version of Common Sense Investing. You'll learn that bond replacement strategy, learn how to protect your retirement against loss, but still participate in market gains. Call now, get your free copy, 866-779-RISK. That's 866-779-RISK, or go to knowyourriskradio.com. Bulwark Capital Management's a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back, you guys, and thank you for sticking with us. We've got our discussion with Professor Dave Colum. And Dave, before we go on, I just want to remind everybody, if you want to follow Dave on Twitter, which I would highly recommend. I was not joking when I said you were by far my most interesting Twitter follow, but they can get you at David B. Colum, C-O-L-L-U-M, on Twitter, and I would highly recommend it. Now, I want to jump back in first and foremost to it's something you alluded to. You started talking about David Andolfato, and One of the reasons we wanted to have you on here, and I know you know this, but we've started talking to our clients about it. Modern monetary theory, or MMT, is coming into the foreground. Most people aren't familiar with the term. Get used to it, because you're going to hear it a lot. And we were lucky enough through Mr. Colum, Professor Colum, talking with him, we were lucky enough to snag an interview with the vice president of the St. Louis Fed, David Andolfato, and we're going to have him on with Professor Colum, and we are going to have an MMT discussion. We're currently working with the media relations department at the St. Louis Fed to work this out. I think this is going to happen at some point in the next month and a half. Mr. Andolfato's got a pretty dense schedule. But before we did that, this is one of the primary reasons we wanted to have you on. I wanted the listeners to get an idea of who was playing the other side of this. I've told you a little bit about our radio station. I think it's probably going to be a little more sympathetic to your take on things, but also really looking forward to hear what David has to say as well, because he's a sharp guy. He knows his stuff. Obviously, he's coming at it from a different angle that you and I are, but I'm fascinated to hear what he has to say. So a little bit of forewarning there. It should be a phenomenal conversation, and really looking forward to it. And you've had your Twitter spats and wars back and forth with, in a respectful manner, in a joking manner, with Mr. Andolfato. Did you see this focus on MMT or modern monetary theory coming? And how familiar were you with the term? Because, this really appeared on the scene, in the last 12 months? It certainly picked up steam. How familiar with you were the term? And kind of give us an overview of what your take is on this developing and this coming to the fore. We referenced it earlier, but kind of, I guess, a preview of, if you will, of this discussion we're going to have and a kind of an outline, a structure, a framework of what is modern monetary theory.
Well, it's been around for about 100 years, actually, but I wasn't familiar with the terms. It originally started by some guy named Knapp, and it was called chartalism and whatever. Years ago, at one of these bear market chat boards, we used to talk about how, in theory, the government does not need to tax us. What they could do is just create money as needed and spend it, and that the tax would appear as inflation. And we used to talk about why don't they do this. And one of the conclusions we drew is that it would then reveal the absurdity of government, right? It would just be too brutally real. And so they have a tax that they can say, look, you get what you pay for, that sort of thing. Meanwhile, they're doing it at some level, right? And that the deficit spending is that. And the other question is, once you get to that, if you stop saying, look, you guys have to pay for it, then what's going to stop us from spending?
Yeah.
And it's a particular problem because inflation is referred to as the hidden tax, and that, there's famous quotes from Yore where it says, there's not one in 1,000 people who understand inflation, right? That sort of thing.
Right.
And so if you are taxing people through the hidden tax, then you are totally anesthetizing the populace as to the consequences of big government. And so that, to me, is a problem. Now, the other problem, I think a lot of modern monetary theory actually makes some sense. And they're saying, look, the bank shouldn't be creating this money like we talked about in the last segment, but the government should. But the problem is the modern monetary theorists view the government as rational players. And it's right. Yeah, I know. What a concept. Yeah. Oh, so you voted for Maxine Waters. Okay, I got it. What it does is it actually leaves the control mechanism of the monetary system in the hands of Congress. And that's just an insane concept.
Well,
Congress in
yeah.
theory oversees the Fed, but at least the Fed is are adults. Now, we would argue, you and I would not even argue that they're acting like idiots at times, but they at least could, in theory, sort of wake up and say, holy cow, we're doing this wrong, we got to change. And Maxine Waters is not going to wake up and say, I'm doing it wrong. And AOC and the whole gaggle of new freshman congresswomen on the Democratic side. And there's a guy named Hank Johnson out there who literally thinks that Guam is going to capsize due to population growth.
I was just going to bring him.
He's a moron of a higher order. And you watch it and you go, oh, he's got to burst into laughter, right? And he's drilling some general, right? And the general says, well, we're not really worried about that.
I literally watched that. For those of you that don't know, Professor Colm just gave you a gift. Okay, go to YouTube and search for Hank Johnson Guam. I watched that clip five times expecting a different outcome, expecting a different dialogue. And I just sat there dumbfounded, and I sat there and thought to myself, if people wonder why our country is screwed up, just watch the clip. Right.
So let me give you another heads up on what's going on in Congress and one of the reasons why I've panicked in the last 3 weeks. Of course, this legendary nitwit AOC has gotten control of the microphone. So it's open mic night in Congress now.
Oh, my goodness.
But there's a storyline out there that sounded preposterous. I'm a big conspiracy theorist. Anyone who doesn't think we conspire is an idiot, in my opinion. We just have to figure out which ones are real and what's happening and where, how deep it goes and stuff
wait,
like
wait
that.
Wait a second, but, Dave, I got to cut you off there because are you telling me that rich, powerful people
conspire,
align their
yeah.
interests? I mean, come on, Dave.
Yeah, call me a nitwit. So in any event, but this someone passes me this video that says, could you please elaborate on this? Do you know anything about it? And some guy, and I'm about to turn it off going, oh, this is legend of internet stuff here. And he starts saying that AOC was recruited by what was essentially a casting call of thousands to figure out who to put up against the Democrat in that district. And I'm going, oh, come on, right? And then they start showing clips, and there she is explaining how her brother submitted her name and that somehow she got chosen and interviewed and got chosen to do it. And it's her saying it. And then he starts talking about it. He says, you ever notice how when she speaks, sometimes she's oddly brilliant?
Yeah.
And other times she's a utter incoherent moron. He says, that's on script, off script. And they start talking about her handlers. It turns out, according to this thesis, and Politico picked up on this back in January, there's a new group called Justice Democrats, well-funded. Their goal, they're super lefties, well-funded. The machine they're using are the Bernie campaign experts.
Oh.
That found themselves unemployed and looking for another fight, and someone very cleverly said, let's use them. And they're good at the social media stuff, and so it was a machine built ready to go, well-funded, and the goal is to take over Congress at the primary level. And so what they're doing is they're trolling for Democratic districts, undeniably Democratic districts, that have incumbents who the people are not terribly pleased with. Maybe Hank Johnson and this capsized guy, right? Who knows? And knocking the Democrats out at the primary. So AOC is the de facto head of the Democratic Party right now. People say, no, she's not. I go, she's got the microphone. Yes, she is. She won her primary with 15,000 votes. That turns out to have been the win. She wasn't going to lose in the election. And they have identified the districts where they can knock out Democrats. So I'm thinking what we're seeing here, and I saw her ripping her Democratic seniors, being crooked and untrustworthy. I'm going,
yeah.
How can a junior Democrat be doing this? All of a sudden it makes sense. They're fighting the Democrats. They're taking over Congress at the primary level, knocking out the beatables. And they're going to take, and this includes this Omar woman. It includes the one, remember the woman who said she was going to impeach the mofo?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? You're right. Same one. They were all recruited to run.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
and you go, oh, this is a creepy theory. You got to watch it to believe it. And Politico lays it all out. And I think it's true. I'm not, but so this is the socialist movement coming right here, right now. And there's brains behind it. AOC's chief of staff is one of them. And it's a scary story. And I think at this point, you got to be rooting for Biden and Pelosi, which is You would have never heard me say that in a million years. That's but like, all that's, of a sudden now.
That's like saying you got to root for cancer and hepatitis C. You know what I mean?
Well,
like,
so the problem is they're the ones who stand between us and these Looney Tunes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's just the whole situation. I can't even get over something as simple as, you know, one of the debates and arguments that we had, you know, I remember having it as early as high school. I was kind of tell you where I've come from politically. My grandfather was the coordinator of the Western United States for the John Birch Society. So I grew up in a family that was...
Mine was the head of the GOP up in Syracuse.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Perfect. So, I tell people I sort of grew up to the right of Attila the Hun. And that sort of devolved into more of a libertarian posture
same.
On my part. Yeah, because, you know, we see the same... You know, everybody sits there and wants to rip Obama for doubling the debt, and I just don't think it's a very intellectually honest argument because Bush did it too.
Right.
You know, double.
No, it's been a long time since the Republicans looked like adults in the room to me, too.
So. Oh, yeah. Well, now, here's the one aspect. Pivoting back, and I think it falls right in line with this discussion as well, but pivoting back to the MMT, the thing that I think is really strange, and it's not, because we're talking about fairly vapid people that I don't think do a lot of critical thinking, but one of the things that shocks me is that you have this socialist movement now, which seems to be sponsored, at least nurtured, or pushed forward by the, you know, our more socially liberal friends, baby boomers from the 60s, and, you know, right alongside that, you've got this modern monetary theory movement. And the thing that I don't really understand about those two things coming together is you've got this supposedly anti-war, peaceful party that doesn't want to hurt anybody and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And yet this modern monetary theory, this deficit spending, all this stuff completely removes any fiscal constraint on government. And
right.
I can't help but thinking of all the conflicts we've seen globally over the last 30 years and thinking that if governments, that fiscal, you know, stopgap or that fiscal limit, money having, you know, not being unlimited in supply, that constrains governments. It keeps them honest to some degree. Are these people not worried at all about government run amok? If their access to capital is unlimited, what can they do? I mean, look what they're doing. I don't understand the marriage of that. We've got the same people that were rioting in the streets in Kent State University in the 60s. They're all backing this socialist movement, modern monetary theory policy. And I'm looking at them going, do you think this is going to result in a more peaceful world?
So here's the problem. I don't think it's a large number of adults supporting it. So you've got, who are the players? You've got a guy named Randall Ray, who does a nice job of explaining banking and then says really stupid stuff. Then you got Stephanie Kelton, who I find totally unconvincing.
Yeah.
There's a guy at Cornell who said he was going to have lunch with me, and then it went quiet. And a guy named Mosler, who I don't really think of as an MMT-er. I listen to him. I go, I'm not hearing it in there. But the problem is we have, what are we at? We're at 7 or 8% growth in the deficit now?
Yeah, I think it's
with
8.
An economy that's growing at 2 to 3%. So we are in a spiral. So and now, meanwhile, we have this setup for the 2020 elections where the rallying cry is going to be, look, in 08, 09, the bankers made it a ton of money. They got rich. Now it's our turn.
Yep.
And so every election, there's always promises about all the free stuff we're going to get. In the past, those were hollow promises, and when the election was over, they'd get behind doors and smoky back rooms and make decisions between the guys who had to vote in Congress and in the Senate, and make decisions that were bad but not horrific. But now in 2020, you're going to see unimaginable levels of free stuff being promised. And they're going to pull the moderate Democrats to the left. They're going to mandate it. So some guy who's a Democrat, I can't remember his name. Someone told me about it today, actually, who started and ran three companies. He's now a Democrat. And someone asked him if he was a capitalist, and he balked.
Wow.
That's what pulling to the left means. So I think the 2020 elections is going to be anti-Trump. And it's going to be, this is now our turn. We want free this. We want jubilees for this debt. We want this. And the problem is, it will sell.
Yeah. And look, this is, and for those of you just joining us, we're being kindly and entertainingly joined by Professor David Colum. And one of the things that is so frustrating to me about that argument, and I completely concur, is that it should be that way. It's rational for people. That is one of my biggest problems with our response to the financial crisis, is because we sowed those seeds. It's only natural, considering the way that the Fed, you know, operated and you know, quantitative easing and all these different things, and the bank bailouts and AIG with $85 billion, all these different things. It's a completely rational response for the public to say, what about us? When do we get our golden parachute, for lack of a better term? When do we get our...
Yeah, it was Obama's biggest disaster. I wasn't a huge Obama fan because he's super left, but I didn't dislike the guy.
Right.
It will be shown to be, in my opinion, a catastrophic decision to try to... Basically, the metaphor I use is they stitched up a festering wound. They didn't clean it. And so now it's festering. First you had Occupy Wall Street. That was a beta test. Then you have Black Lives Matter. You have Antifa. You have all these things. They're trying to tell us there's a bunch of right-wingers. It's like, where are the right-wingers? Where are the Nazis, right? If you walk down the street with a swastika, you're going to get killed.
Oh.
Now we're in this class warfare situation. You want to find Russia collusion? It's not about the elections. It's not about Trump. It's Hillary. Certainly it's Hillary. Unambiguously it's Hillary. But if the Russians are colluding, if the Russians are getting in our heads, they're fueling these political divides at the street level.
Yeah,
that's where I'd be putting my energy. Some ex-KGB guy got interviewed, and he said, we didn't spend time spying on you guys. We spent time disrupting your society as much as we could.
Yeah, and it's that whole enemy within argument. And
that's how you bring down an empire.
Right.
No one's going to bring us down from the outside. They're going to get us to eat ourselves.
Well, and they're succeeding. I mean,
they're winning big. This is why I'm terrified. And it really is. It's the appearance of an MMT, by the way, is just people's. We're hitting this deficit of 7-8% and no end in sight. And we can't afford a 7-8% deficit in perpetuity. That just blows up. And so along conveniently comes this theory that says, as Cheney said, deficits don't matter. Yeah. The theory provides this intellectual framework to say, you know, it's really good for the economy if big government gets even bigger. Now, if you talk to MMTers, they will deny stuff. And there's a lot of different kinds of MMTers. But what will happen is some will say this and some will say that, and they're always denying the stupid stuff the other one says. And they always say, the MMTers are going to tell you, oh, we worry a lot about inflation, I go, enough to put Congress in charge of it. So their idea, by the way, is that when inflation is tame, they ramp up the number of government jobs. And you go, okay, when inflation's out of control, what do you do? Are you going to stand up? When was the last time you heard a politician stand up and say, because we have inflation, I'm going to pass this bill that will decrease the number of jobs in the country? When was the last time you heard that speech?
Yeah, I'm still waiting for it.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for it too.
Yeah,
So this is stupidity of a higher order, and I've tried so hard to understand their case. By the way, and Alfado, he finds a lot of problems with MMT, but he entertains it. And that's what if he can get him on the show, we'll make it interesting. Maybe he can explain it to us. I don't know. But he entertains it.
Well, and he has said, just as an update, he said he's in. So we
oh, he did?
Yeah, I'm working.
Well, I saw he say he's in, but he's just trying to pick a date. Yeah,
yeah.
You didn't mention the funniest part. You and I were setting up the interview, and he jumped in and said, what about having both of us?
Yes. Yeah, he invited himself.
And I'm thinking, yeah, sure. Yeah. You should take him up on that,
oh,
right?
Yeah. Oh, and yeah, I leapt at the opportunity. I was sitting there going, this is, you talk about great radio. And I mean, and I know you do as well. I mean it in a very respectful manner. I want to hear him out. You know, we don't do combative interviews or anything like that. I want to hear the guy out. He's obviously a smart guy, has an interesting background, and My whole issue with this whole thing, like I said, there's no constraint on government, right? That's a worry to me. It continues to amaze me the failure of history and the failure of, I shouldn't say history, the failure of the academic institutions to properly teach history. You know, you sit there and you try to explain this to people that aren't familiar and you go, look, the biggest thing you've got to fear, and this goes back to the beginning of time, is that, you know, the greatest genocides, the greatest atrocities have been perpetrated by governments, yet we've suspended, all judgment or all, skepticism when it comes to government. And in that way, I feel like we're reflecting a lot of, you know, the Soviet Union and in the, 70s and 80s, certainly during the Cold War periods. And you, like you said, you just see this ushering in of socialism because it sounds so good and everybody's tired of the way things are. And then they talk about the failure of capitalism. And this is kind of, to me, where it comes around. You know, my grandfather used to have a saying where he said the extreme of any or the extreme of any position eventually becomes its opposite. And in a lot of ways, I feel like the incredibly ridiculous manner in which we've operated capitalism has sort of earned this, right?
I tweeted that the other day. You know, sometimes tweets go viral. That one went viral. I said that this rising socialism was not helped by capitalism doing such a bad job.
No.
And people say, well, this isn't capitalism. I go, well, they're claiming this isn't socialism either, so be careful there. So I think the capitalists have blown it. And we didn't even talk about stock buybacks. I've done a little math, by the way. When a company does stock buybacks, if they chase up the share price at all, the shareholders are losing, not winning.
Yep.
It's an amazingly simple arithmetic. If a company chased the shares up today with assets on their balance sheet, and at the end of the day the price was higher, we'd all feel richer, and it turns out the tangible assets underlying each share will have dropped.
Yeah.
It's that crazy. $1 trillion a year of what I consider to be close to a scam. It's not always a bad idea, but, you know, so they're doing that, right? They're doing all these things and you know, you got massive compensation packages, and you say, well, it's the free market. I go, not when your friends are on the board deciding your salary and you're on their boards deciding their salaries, right? That's not capitalism.
That's collusion, yeah.
That's collusion. Oh, another conspiracy. Oh, my God.
The rich people helping each other get richer. Yeah, how far out, right? How unlikely. The buyback, you got me, you baited me there, and I'm taking it. The buyback madness to me has gotten completely. Clifford Asness, a guy that I respect, and I think that a brilliant guy, and his track record speaks for itself. He's kind of fought the other side of this buyback agreement, at least on social media, saying it can
be. But he's fighting the bad ideas, though. Clifford Asness goes out there, and I posted one of his articles, and Cliff's been really helpful to me through the years, so I really don't want to be critical.
Oh, yeah.
What Cliff says about the buybacks is not wrong.
Right, right.
What he focuses on is the stupid ideas. So, for example, the people who say you shouldn't do share buybacks, you should make the companies invest in this or do this or do that. You go, no, you shouldn't.
Nope.
Right?
Yep.
And he's jumping on that. He knows that the top executives who have huge stock options have a huge incentive to do buybacks, not pay dividends. When they pay a dividend, their shares go down in value. When they do buybacks, the share price goes up, not what's underlying the share, but the share price goes up. And so there's a malincentive here to do the buybacks. That's the thing that drives me nuts. And if you're buying back expensive shares, you are either an idiot or a crook.
Well, and we did an expose. Well, that's kind of a general term. Maybe I'm giving it too much credit. I don't think my work deserves the term expose. But we did a dive into Palo Alto Networks. And I think this is just a poster child for it, right? The way I've always looked at it is there are two conditions, maybe more. Feel free to tweet me or email me if you think I've got this wrong and there's things that, you know, other circumstances. But if you look at stock buybacks, I think there's two general situations in which they make sense. A, when you got a mature company whose cash flow is best, you know, used in some other way, they can't invest it in their own corporation or they don't believe they can invest it in such a way that makes sense. So it's a way of,
you know, giving back to the shareholders and concentrating their ownership in the company. And then, you know, also when you've got a mature company and the stock price is too cheap. Outside of that, I don't think that stock buybacks, from my opinion, correct me if I'm wrong, but in my opinion, I don't think they're any different than the way you should buy stock, period. And when you look at a company like Palo Alto Networks, a great company. One of the things that attracted us to attracted us to them to kind of spur our research on them was I think they've got some great products in the space and in the security space. I think they're doing a great job. Then when you look at the underlying fundamentals of the company and you got a company that's trading at, I want to say, 8.5 to 9 times sales, right?
We're back to that one, yeah.
Yeah, we're back to those numbers. And then you've got, then you go look at the balance sheet or you go look at the cash flow statement and you've got $2.3 billion worth of revenue and still negative cash flow. So I'm sitting there going, okay, we've got eight to nine times sales over here on a valuation. We've got negative cash flow, and at the same time they come out and announce a $1 billion buyback, I sit there and kind of scratch my head, go look at the balance sheet. Sure enough, they'd taken out, you know, they'd issued a billion dollars worth of debt to finance it. And I'm sitting there looking at this going, how does this not blow up? Eventually, there's going to be a board meeting.
So there's a number of things going on with buybacks. If a company buys back shares and extinguishes the shares, that's as good as you could hope for. If they buy it back with cash on the balance sheet and they extinguish the shares, that's as good as it can get right there. That at least is the old Peter Lynch model. The company says maybe these shares are cheap. Now, if the shares are expensive, they're stupid. They should pay a dividend because the shares are way too pricey. I'd rather get my money out of it.
Right.
But if they're using the buybacks to extinguish shares that are being offered to the executives as options, now, it's legal. It is public knowledge, but to the average person, they don't understand when they hear a share buyback, a $1 billion share buyback, that many of these companies, the number of shares will not even shrink.
Right.
And so it's this sort of cheese balling in plain sight model that they're doing, where they're counting on the public to either have no say or to not care or to not notice that the buybacks are not returned. You're not returning capital to investors. That's the stupid thing. If they're really returning capital to you, let me ask you this. Can you go buy a car with it? The answer is no. You have to sell the shares. Well, guess what? I can do that anyways. And so the other thing about thinking about the buybacks is it's another one of these asset swaps. So you got $100 billion on the balance sheet, and you can go buy shares of your own company for $100 billion, which is going to be a better return going forward. And if your $100 billion is invested sort of rationally, conservatively, if it would have done better than your overpriced shares, it was a bad deal.
Yeah. No, Now,
the corporate debt-based ones, people make the argument, yeah, but when money's really cheap and, you know, it's a good thing to do. No, they're hedge funds at that point. No. They should not be borrowing money to buy back shares. Just on a principle, if I hear my son is borrowing money at real cheap prices to buy shares, I would spank his ass so fast. I'd say, no, you're going to get hurt. This is stupid. It's the same argument people say, well, should I hang on to my mortgage because it's like, no, I'll tell you what, you could.
Yeah.
But I think you just ought to pay the thing off, right? You shouldn't be so enthusiastic about carrying debt. But the company should not be borrowing to buy back shares. Unless, see, here's where it gets complicated again. If they've got the cash offshore and they're borrowing the money because they haven't yet done this scam we call repatriation. Now, I don't have a problem with money coming back, you know, tax cheap.
Yeah.
But they say, oh, this is a one-time deal, stimulate the economy. Baloney. Every 7 or so years, they have a one-time only repatriation of foreign capital.
Right.
From overseas. And they keep doing it over and over and over. And here's why it's so evil. It's because the big companies can do it and the small companies can't.
Yes.
And
yes.
Small companies are where our growth comes from. And so they're undermining the little guys who are going to make things happen. And they're giving this big break to the big guys who are bloated, slow-growing, you know, garbage companies that have gotten too big for their own good. And that's why repatriation is unfair, because you're giving the breaks to the guys who are not going to help the economy.
Yeah, and
not the way.
Yeah, and you got a huge crowding out. Okay, I can't believe this, but we've already run through our allotted time.
Okay.
Professor, thank you so much for joining us. And for the listeners, again, I can't recommend it enough. Follow Dave on or the good professor, as I refer to him. Follow him on Twitter, at David B. Cullum. And then stay tuned, because we're going to have Dave back on, hopefully more than once, because I love your insights. I love the way you look at things. But we're going to at least have you on one more time for our little MMT showdown, so I want the listeners to stay tuned for that. Professor, thank you so much for joining us today. I hope it's not the last time. I hope we didn't offend your sensibilities too much. But thank you so much for joining us, and it's been a real pleasure.
You betcha.
All right. Well, we'll see you again soon. And all the listeners out there, thank you so much for joining. Stick with us. We're going to do a little bit of a recap and a market update. But we will be right back. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
This is Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham. Listen to Zach uncover the truth about the financial markets with simple and honest advice to help you plan for retirement. Get your free copy of Zach's new booklet, Common Sense Investing. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Volatile markets are never fun, but it provides the opportunity to see exactly how much risk you're exposed to. Like Warren Buffett always says, when the tide goes out, you find out who's been swimming without their trunks on. Hey, it's Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. Chances are the defense portion of your portfolio, the bonds, got hit right along with your stocks. So what do? Look, safety doesn't have to mean lower returns. By using our bond replacement strategy, our clients have actually increased their returns while being insured against loss and all the while lowering their fees. Call now and get your free copy of our brand new booklet, Common Sense Investing, and learn how to protect your retirement against loss but still participate in market gains. Call 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Or go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Bulwark Capital Management's a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, registered investment advisor.
I have to tell you, what a relief for my wife and me when we got signed up for long-term care coverage. The more I learned about the fact that nearly 3 out of 4 of us will need some form of long-term care in our retirement, there are so many issues at play. For some people, they can't afford it and they become a burden on their friends and family. For others, you do have money set aside, but it wipes out everything that you've saved. And maybe most importantly, it's about having a plan so that all your children have to do is carry out your wishes. It's not a burden on them. And that's why I love the advice we got from Brian Ott and 525 Advisors. We started by going to one of Brian's free classes, and that's what I recommend you do to find out about all the different plans they offer. Brian does have a few classes coming up this month. Seats are limited, so sign up now at 525longtermcare.com. You'll get a free copy of Brian's book, too. Go to 525longtermcare.com, 525longtermcare.com.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back. And you'll have to forgive the format a little bit. We had some time constraints and had to put our interview with David Cullum, Professor Cullum, first. And I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. David is a interesting guy. I mean, right down to the fact that he is a libertarian, conservative, not so much Republican, conservative. But he's also a PhD. The guy's got an academic pedigree that would rival anybody. A PhD professor at Cornell. So there's kind of your first disconnect, right, where you're going, okay, I'm interested. You're a rare bird, a bit of a unicorn in that way. And then, you know, he's an expert on Osprey. And we didn't get into that as much. We'll have him on again. There's so much to ask. There's so much to talk about. Fascinating guy. Great storyteller. Anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. Because, you know, the other thing is that for a guy that doesn't live in the world of finance and investing, he does his homework. He really gets it. He's had some phenomenal returns as well, needless to say. And the other thing I love about it is just plain spoken. There's some brilliant guys in this industry that listening to them talk. Hopefully you don't sit there and go, yeah, Zach, it's like you. But, you know, other than the brilliant aspect, I'm certainly not putting myself on that pedestal. But I just like the guys that can break things down in plain spoken English. You know, if you truly understand something, you should be able to synthesize it and discuss it in very simple terms. And that's what I love about Professor Colum. He just doesn't pull any punches. You know where he sits. So anyway, hope you guys enjoyed that. And then also, like we said in the interview, familiarize yourself with the idea or the concept of modern monetary theory, MMT, whatever you want to call it, because you're going to hear about it, right? It's going to take center stage, whether we like it or not. And it's going to be something that we all have to contend with. It's probably going to make your head hurt. To me, it reeks of the ultimate rationalization that leads societies and economies down these paths of no return that end up in tears. And the way it's sold, right, social, it just reeks of that to me, right? The road to hell is paved with good intentions. And I think over a long enough timeline, you know, MMT is going to be seen as that. Hopefully I'm wrong, but it sure seems like things are headed that way. So anyway, let's get into it. Market update. Like I said, things are a little bit out of order. And also a two-hour show. You're probably sitting there going, "Man, have you guys expanded?" No, we just had we got skipped a couple times because of sporting events and games, and so KTTH did me a solid and threw an extra hour airtime toward us. Which, you know, for me it works great because we were always running. I don't need to tell you guys this, but we're always running over the stops, running over the breaks. There's always too much to get to for an hour. But anyway, markets this week. Hey. If you're long, been a solid week. We are. Thank goodness. And I will continue to say, though, look, I've been doing this job for 40 years, but I've been in this industry now for, what are we at, coming up on 13, 14, 15 years anyway. I continue to say that I've never seen a ramp like this. I've never seen a ramp this vertical, this fast, while economic data is literally moving the other direction at the same speed. And again, I want to emphasize, it's not recessionary data that we're seeing. It's not apocalyptic. It's not horrible. It's just going the other direction on a lot of different metrics. And yet stocks are just rallying to beat all heck. Beat all heck. See, there's some radio language, right? Some constraint or restraint by me. But it's dumbfounding. The speed that this rally has taken place. And I will continue to warn you guys, look, you know, maybe we're heading to new all-time highs. I continue to urge caution because the underlying fundamentals aren't there. This looks and feels so much like a... But here's the other side of it, guys. Again, and this is why we're not trying to time markets. This is starting to look less and less like a bear market rally, which we thought it was. You know, I've said, well, if we get it wrong, I'm not going to hide from it. Now, there's some key points that this market's got to hit to prove to us that it's more than a bear market rally. And there's no question. I think 2850 is really big. And then obviously the previous all-time highs, 2940 on the S&P are huge. But it's making less and less sense every single day, and it hasn't made sense for quite a while. The other thing that's really concerning to me, guys, is, and this is definitely more on the anecdotal side of things, is the level. I have talked to four different retail investors over the space of the last 3 weeks alone who have taken out margin accounts, debt, right, levering up. And also home equity lines of credit to buy stocks. This is so end of cycle. It's so cliche. It hurts. And like I said, you might be excited about the market action. You know, just know you're dancing on a trapdoor. And I have no clue when that trapdoor opens. I just know that the disconnect between prices and underlying fundamentals is like, you know, it's kind of the level that I just didn't think that I'd see. You know, I was having a conversation with a client about it yesterday, and he was asking about this stock and that stock. And I said to him, look, I you know,
regardless of what we think is going to happen with a stock, I cannot buy a $5 billion stock when it's got $30 million of revenue. I just can't do it. And what you need to know if you're doing this, if you're out there buying the Palo Alto Networks of the world, and look, I say this knowing that there's a real possibility 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, I look like an idiot because these things could go up another 40%. That's entirely possible. But just know, if you're playing this game, you're not investing. You're gambling. It's the greater fool theory of investing. You're buying something because you think it's going to go up, and you've completely separated that from the underlying fundamentals or the underpinnings of what connotate and make up value. So just know that. That's a fact. It's the most expensive stock market in U.S. history. That's a fact. Now, we can pick in some metrics that don't say, you know, that say it's not. But the overwhelming, you know, price to market capitalization, price to sales, market cap to GDP, all these different metrics. More importantly, the ones that cannot be manipulated by stock buybacks, debt-fueled stock buybacks, they're all screaming the same story. And you heard Professor Collum's thought on it. So, you know, look, we continue to be cautious, and we need to be. So, hey, and now let's move over. Market update. Look, that's the story, right? There's really nothing of note, I don't think, other than markets just continue to go up in the opposite direction of underlying economic fundamentals. And it's pretty amazing. The flip side is I'm glad that we don't time markets. I'm glad we didn't try to liquidate everything. Because, 20%, I want to say we're off the bottom now. Anyway, pretty amazing. Let's get into another conversation. Boeing, for those of you who listen to the show or the podcast, you know we had some pretty strong words about Boeing about 2 weeks ago, maybe three. It was on March 1st, so 2 weeks ago. Let me start. That caused a lot of waves. I was actually shocked by it. I didn't really think anybody was paying attention. I thought this was kind of the random, you know, musings of a guy yelling into the wind. We ruffled some feathers, and I want to make it very clear. We talked about this on the show last week as well. I have no ill will with Boeing. I have no ill will with any of the companies we talk about. I think Boeing's a phenomenal company. We have employees whose parents work at Boeing still. I've got family that works at Boeing. We're not wishing them any ill will whatsoever. In matter of fact, it's the opposite. I live in this community, right? But we need to separate the company from the stock. And I didn't know that there was going to be crashes. I'm certainly not celebrating it. It's a tragic loss of life. But this is, and I sent this out to a client of ours, former client of ours. That's another story. Who is a big Boeing fan. And guys, this is the danger of buying things that are very overvalued. Because remember, if you think back to that segment, now listen, I'm also not saying I know which direction Boeing's going. Maybe it shoots right back to all-time highs. That wouldn't surprise me. Not in this market. Nothing really makes sense. This is all just momentum investing driven by algorithm. You know, it's, you know, it's just crazy. That being said, I didn't have any insight that, you know, there was quality control issues with the 737. What I'm saying is that when you have a security or an equity that is priced to perfection at that level and is buying back that much stock and is so focused on share price, and I put a tweet out earlier, or it was yesterday, maybe today, where I said, look, you can't serve two masters. If you are focused almost, you know, singularly on share price appreciation, you got to know by default, you can't be focused solely and exclusively on the health and underlying performance of the company. And those are two different things. But getting to my main point, when you see a stock that is trading at that kind of multiple, and again, when you compare it to other companies on the street, there's a lot worse offenders. And I'm not arguing that point. But when you see it valued to that level, no business, it's like a personal life, right? No business, nobody's life runs perfectly. Nobody's. There's always hiccups. And as a matter of fact, the great managers, and you could extrapolate this over to life as well. I was just listening to a podcast with Tony Dungy and Brock Huard, which is a phenomenal podcast, by the way. But Tony Dungy talking about the loss of his son, right? This incredible man of moral and integrity and you know, loses his son. Nobody gets out of here free, and it's the same in the markets. There are going to be issues. And when you see a stock price to perfection, and your story behind buying that stock is you essentially saying that I think that this company is going to execute flawlessly for the next decade, that should cause you some pause. I didn't need to know that a plane was falling out of the sky. I just needed to know that, look, it's life. Things are going to happen. You know, there are going to be missteps along the way. And when that happens, you're going to see a stock drop 15% in the course of a few days. And now, I think it's there is no reality in the pricing of this market. Despite what you hear Jim Cramer say, I don't know what he's talking about. I heard him the other day talking about Microsoft is a cheap stock. And, you know, I try not to discount those guys, right? I've been wrong too many times. If you do this business long enough, you will be too. But we looked up and down, and I'm sitting there going, I don't understand what in the world he sees cheap about the stock. It's anything but. This is insane. But this is the mania that's grabbed this market. It's fundamentals be damned. All we care about is share price appreciation. And this too shall pass. And usually, it passes at, or you know, these things devolve at the period of maximum euphoria. And look, I haven't, like I said, I've said it many times, especially in the last month, I have never seen a level of investor euphoria among retail investors like I do today. And, you know, at the same time, that's anecdotal. So it doesn't mean impending doom. But man, the imbalances are huge. They really are. And you know, going back to that value approach that we use that frustrates some of our clients sometimes when markets are going parabolic like this, when we see stocks valued to perfection like Boeing was just a month ago, it doesn't take much to upset the apple cart, right? And if you think back to August or September of last year, we said the exact same thing about Netflix. We said the exact same thing about these FANG stocks. Netflix dropped 43%. It's not that we have a crystal ball. It's not that we're clairvoyant. Good Lord, I could show you some moves that we've made that have been wrong. Not saying that at all. Just saying there's obvious tells, guys. And know what you're investing in. And avoid momentum investing. Because it's not going to last. And there will be tough times. So anyway, we've gone on enough about that. Let's close up that segment. We're going to be right back, kind of wrap things up. Got a couple other quick things to discuss. But as always, if you're interested in the way that we're thinking, if our call, even if you just want to, a guy called me yesterday and just want to talk about our, well, several calls actually, about what we were talking about with Boeing and Palo Alto. And if you're interested in our take and the way we look at these things, if you realize that safety is of increasing performance, or excuse me, increasing importance every single day, and you want to know how we're dialing back the risk in our client portfolios, but still get them plenty of upside, right? We're not running and hiding. If you want to know how we're cutting most clients' fees down by 40-50% and giving them more upside participation in the market, while massively reducing their exposure to risk, give us a call, 866-779-RISK. You can go to the radio show website, knowyourriskradio.com. You can go to Bulwark's website. You can Google us, sign up for the podcast. You don't want to miss the debate, the Modern Monetary Theory Showdown we're going to do with David Collum and David Andolfato. Anyway, we got to run. Stick with us. We'll be right back. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
What does outside-the-box investing really look like? Schedule your free risk review with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management, and see a side-by-side comparison of your current portfolio versus one Zach would recommend. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com.
Hey, it's Story Monson with my financial advisor, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. And Zach, what I love about you guys is your focus on risk management.
Well, Dory, we're a fiduciary and a holistic retirement planning firm. Our goals are simple. Get our clients the highest returns with the least amount of risk and cost.
I know they're normally used for safety, but how risky are bonds right now?
If a significant portion of your retirement portfolio is in cash or bonds, that just doesn't work in this low interest rate environment on the verge of inflation. You need a bond replacement strategy.
I gotta tell you, you have to read it. Zach's brand new version of Common Sense Investing. You'll learn that bond replacement strategy, learn how to protect your retirement against loss, but still participate in market gains. Call now, get your free copy, 866-779-RISK. That's 866-779-RISK, or go to knowyourriskradio.com. Bulwark Capital Management's a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back for the final segment here. And we're going to try to put a bow on things for you today. A little something I want to talk about was what to watch going forward. I think our analyst and I were going actually over this morning. And then as an update, guys, one of the best weekly runs on the S&P, or the best weekly run on the S&P now since November. Market was up 2.5% this week, according to my calculations. Could be a little off there. Maybe it was 2.6, somewhere around there. Heck of a run. Like I said, keep an eye on the economic data. If you want to really know what to watch, we're watching the ISMs and the PMI numbers. There's several different metrics baked into there. Keeping an eye on that. Very good gauges on the economic environment. We continue to watch this absolute smashing of the VIX, the volatility index. You know, and I hate, like I said, I hate to say stuff like this because you set yourself up. I just don't think I've ever recall seeing a market more offside compared to the data that's coming out. I just can't urge you to be careful enough. And if you, like I said, if you want to know how to reduce your risk exposure and still participate and not quote unquote miss out, right? FOMO, fear of missing out. Give us a call, 866-779-RISK. And look, we're not going to twist your arm and, try to bully you into a portfolio. It's pretty simple. We just sit there and show you our portfolios, the performance, the cost, how we're doing things, our bond replacement strategy that we're using that's been phenomenal. It's, I think, our most popular one's up more than 20% over the last 3 years, you know, which is exceptional outperformance when it comes to bonds. And our clients aren't paying a fee for it, not even to us. So if you want to know how to reduce your risk and increase your upside, give us a call, 866-779-RISK. And then what to look at going forward. I think one of the things to pay attention to are a lot of these high flyers. One of them is the Trade Desk, Shopify. Some of these high flyers, typically, you know, Palo Alto Networks would be another one. We've talked plenty about that. But keep an idea, because these things are going parabolic. Several of them are up 100, 120%, 130% over the last 3 months. Okay? Crazy. And that's one of the things, ironically, that makes me think this could have more legs to run in it, because this might be, it's very possible this could end up being the blow off top that everybody kind of written off because of last year. And then it could be just a bear market rally. We don't have insights. What I will tell you is now is the time to be cautious. It just is. And everybody's like, Zach, you've been saying that for years. Okay, well, let's do an update. Okay, the market is basically where it was 15 months ago, 14 months ago, something like that. We're right there. We're still below the all-time highs that were set last September. Okay, just keep an eye on that. In market terminology, or in technical analysis, we refer to that as a rounded top. It's not typically a good sign. So dampen that enthusiasm a little bit. Try to see the forest for the trees. Okay, because I don't know when it's going to come apart. No one does. What I'm telling you is the valuations, if you're all pumped up, if you're one of those guys, like I said, I've talked to four of them in the last 3 weeks, something like four or five of them in the last 3 weeks. If you're one of those people out there that thinking now is the time to lever up, now is the time to get a margin account going, now is the time to take a home equity line of credit, just don't. Even if you don't call us, I'll walk you through why. And you don't even have to talk to us, you can just shoot emails. I'll walk you through the fundamentals of it and give you the real data. Okay, but don't do it. This is the longest bull market in U.S. history, most rich valuations, and I'm just telling you that the underlying economic activity is literally going the other way. Pay attention to the fundamentals. And if you're not having this conversation with your advisor, your money manager, you should be.
And like we've said on the show so many times, when was the last time you heard the CEO of one of these banks come out and say, now's not a good time to buy stocks? They're never going to tell you that. They're never going to tell their advisors that. Don't wait for that warning sound, or don't wait for that warning siren to sound. It ain't going to happen. And if you want a fresh perspective, guys, give us a call, 866-779-RISK. Go to the radio show website, knowyourriskradio.com. Go read our white paper by Roger Ibbotson we've put up there. Sign up for the newsletter. We got a piece coming out in the newsletter this weekend, actually. And also sign up for the radio show podcast. Go to Know Your Risk Radio. You can sign up on mynorthwest.com. You can sign up to our YouTube page. Just stick Bulwark Capital, Know Your Risk Radio, in the YouTube channel. Subscribe to that. Follow us on Twitter at KYR Radio. And inform yourself. Anyway, have a wonderful weekend. Weather's looking nice. Hope you guys enjoy it. As always, we will be back next week. Behave yourselves. Keep an eye on the markets. And until next week, we'll see you soon. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.